sound crazy.
I met him in a club hanging out one night. He said, hello, I'm George. Highlight, how's everything going, huh? How you doing?
I love that. Shout out to the legend, MC Light. Welcome to another week of We Sound Crazy, your official backstage pass to music and culture. Billionaire is in the building. I've arrived.
You're here.
Claude Kelly is definitely here.
Chuck Harmony is here.
And we're missing one.
Oh, there is empty seat over there.
Bacone from Macon.
Oh, yeah. It's Bacone from Macon.
Timon Bacon from Macon is not here.
Your location.
Nah, truth be told, Timon is actually on location.
Yeah, man.
He's our special correspondent. He's in D.C.
D.C. for the RIAA Pioneers of Hip Hop event.
Ooh. Prestigious things.
Big things.
But he's on location for We Sound Crazy. We'll tell you a little more about it in a second, but, you know, he's going to talk to the cool people while we sit back here and hold down the fort.
But I'm just excited. Hip Hop turns 50 next August. Can y'all believe that? It's crazy.
It's kind of hard to believe.
That's
actually crazy.
Because
50 is like such a nice round number. It feels... We're at 50 already?
Yeah, hip-hop literally turns 50 next August. But here, you know, we sound crazy. We all things hip-hop, too. We every genre.
We all of it.
So we got to acknowledge the hip-hop greatness. More to come on that. We got some surprises coming in these upcoming episodes.
Definitely. It was crazy.
I was looking at this list, I think it was last week or week before last, and it was talking about the richest musicians of all time. And it was crazy because Kanye topped the list, and it was Jay-Z, and there's a couple other people. And it was really alarming at first because I'm like, of all time, you know what I'm saying? That's the time that we're living in. But then you realize that for so many years in the music business, creators weren't able to get what they actually
deserve
financially. And so hip-hop has been a part of writing that wrong to some degree, because they are the richest musicians of all time. I'm talking about pop artists and Broadway and everything. They are the richest. And so
incredible.
It's
very much incredible.
It just speaks to the value of the hip hop, the music and the movement that it was, because it actually put us in some spaces where we can build our own tables.
Plus, we all been watching the Murder, Inc. thing on BET, the Murder, Inc. documentary on BET.
So good.
It is so good,
It's so
man.
Good, right? And the thing about it is, like, there's so many rich stories to tell in there. Obviously, this is Irv's storytelling. It's incredible. But first of all, to his credit, you forget how involved he was in hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Like, period.
Just hip-hop.
Jay-Z, DMX.
Ja Rule. I mean, and all the executives that are all... I mean, the record labels, Def Jam and all this stuff. It's just... insane. But then strongly suggest you watch it if you haven't watched it. But besides from the actual Murder, Inc. story, the number, like the record sales. DMX was selling 14 million in a year between two albums. Jay-Z coming to 8-9 million. Ja Rule beating them both the next year. And this is for several years. And so when you say they're the richest.
What did he say when he did two or three, he thought he had failed?
Yeah,
he thought he failed.
And I remember around like 2000, 2001, like there was the pop artists, like the fandom, like you're talking about Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Britney Spears, were selling like close to, if not over, a million per album. And so was DMX and Jay-Z.
It's incredible.
And Ja Rule.
Yeah.
But Murder, Inc. has such a run, because there was a point in the early to mid 2000s where you could not turn on the radio and hear multiple Murder, Inc. songs, whether it was Murder, Inc., the label, or songs they were creating for artists like Jennifer Lopez or Mary J. Blige. Like, it was a true movement.
It was a movement. And I'm glad they're telling their stories, because as we get to the 50th, you start to see, like, well, the sacrifices that were made. But also, like, the progress.
The progress.
Because the progress is crazy. Like, there's several billionaires that are hip-hop artists now. And for us, who I think grew up kind of, like, in the Biggie Tupac era of, like, that was kind of, like, how I formulate hip-hop is, like, Bad Boy and Death Row and all that stuff happening. It's even seeing Jay-Z in the documentary, but it's period. Just seeing Jay-Z and Nas, all these people, like, to see them as adults... So you see, like, what it looks like over, like, past the date, like, the quote-unquote danger zone of it all. I mean, at the time, they were all, like, in court cases or getting shot at. Or it's been crazy. So now to watch them grown up and be almost mostly all billionaires, Puff is a billionaire.
Yeah.
And just talking about the experience, it's just the progress is nuts.
It really is.
Progress is nuts.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, hip hop is, I mean, it's what the most, I would say it's the most powerful black music genre in the world right now. It's the problem, it's the most powerful genre in the world, period. But in terms of what the ones we consider black, it's just, it dominates everything.
Fat Joe said it's black and brown.
It's black and brown.
He said that, you know, hip hop was founded by both black and brown people. I don't know that part of the history.
I don't know it either.
Yeah, but that's what Fat Joe said.
I know.
Shout out to Joe.
I know Jamaica and the Bronx and
yes.
I was trying to save this clip, but somebody posted this clip of this jazz artist that was actually rapping, and it was like in the early 60s or 70s, and so it's just like it's been around forever, but just the way that we were able to capitalize, that got to be the story for black people, because we were always downtrodden because of finance, and so for us to be able to capitalize off that is, I'm so proud of hip hop.
It's interesting because there's always this debate now about like the RC at the table and all that kind of stuff, and maybe it's because I think there's like these two separate groups about how people view hip hop, but hip hop and all the parts of it and the business of it and how it and the fashion of it and all that stuff just totally defies the odds, because technically black, like especially through hip hop, we're everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like I just saw a clip of an interview that's to come with Megan Thee Stallion with Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton, that's talking about just like it's not even for a political campaign. It's just she's on their podcast talking about issues.
Talking about WAP.
She's gonna quote some lyrics.
You know, Hillary keeps hot sauce in her purse, so it could be anything.
I wonder
at this
if she
point.
Got that same bottle.
She that same bottle in her purse. Next time you see someone, should ask her what brand, just to throw her off. So, what brand of hot sauce do you have in your purse?
You know, the brand all everybody uses.
same brand that B uses.
Oh, that's so good.
Oh man,
we sound crazy.
So guys, the RIAA recently celebrated their pioneers of hip hop in Washington, D.C., which is where Timon is, with all the exclusive conversations. So this year, they wanted to highlight the contributions of Grandmaster Flash, legend. MC Light, legend. Universal Music Group's General Counsel and EVP of Business and Legal Affairs, Jeff Harlston, who's one of my mentors, a legend. And House Democratic Caucus Chairman, Hakeem Jeffries. So they were the four honorees for this year's celebration.
Okay,
that's cool, man.
And the extra cool part is the RIAA co-hosted this event with our partners at the National Museum of African American Music here in Nashville.
Shout out, Naaman, doing big
things.
Yeah,
I mean, Timon gets to talk to all the cool people, is what I'm saying. Because I mean, come on, like MC Light, all these kind of people. Come on.
Jazzy Jeff? Come
Jazzy
on.
Jazzy Jeff?
I'm jealous.
Jazzy Jeff.
What?
Yeah. We're just going to go.
Let's just go. Timon, over to you.
he takes it over this episode. Bacon, what up?
We sound crazy.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy Bacon from Macon. As they said, y'all, I went to D.C., had an amazing time, was able to talk with so many legends. Crazy. So many people that I grew up watching and listening to on my tape deck. CD players, watching them on TV, amazing experience. RIAA honors Washington, D.C. And I was able to talk with them about just the history of hip-hop culture and how far we've come, celebrating 50 years next year. So first up is a man who's accomplished many a milestone in his career, including winning the first rap Grammy for Parents Just Don't Understand, and being one of the most prolific DJs in the last 35 to 40 years. I'm talking about none other than the iconic DJ Jazzy Jeff. Check it out, y'all. What's up, good people? It's your boy Bacon from Macon with the We Sound Crazy podcast, and I am on location in Washington, D.C., y'all. Typically, we would have four of us, but it's just one of me today. And shout out to my brothers Claude, Chuck, and Phil back in Nashville. But I'm here at the RIAA studios here in Washington, D.C., in the midst of legends, and it's crazy because
these legends are people that I grew up watching on TV, listening to them in my tape decks, in my CD players. And it's just, it's crazy to finally get a chance to touch elbows with these people and tell them just how much they mean to the culture. As you can see right here, we have the legendary DJ Jazzy Jeff. How are you, sir?
I'm beautiful. How are you?
I'm good. So we're here, RIAA honors. As someone who has seen hip-hop and its many transitions from its infancy, what is going through your head right now, like, for us to be in a place right now and they are honoring hip-hop and we're coming up on 50 years next year?
Yeah.
What is going through your mind right now in everything that you've seen?
Probably the main thing is that we have surpassed anything that I could have ever imagined.
Wow.
Starting off in hip-hop when we were extremely afraid of it ending because people didn't believe in it, to think that next year is the 50th anniversary. Hip-hop is global. Like,
yes.
You know, hip-hop is taking me places that I never dreamed of. You know, we have definitely surpassed anything that was in my imagination.
Wow, wow. Speaking of people not believing in it, it makes me think of... So first of all, he is part of the duo to win the very first rap Grammy ever.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
Like, it's absolutely crazy. But that same year, you all boycotted the Grammys.
Mm-hmm.
Take me back to that moment where the collective, you and Will and Salt and Pepper and just the artists that were out at the time, take me back to that moment where you all collectively decided, you know what, we're not going to take this. We have to take a stand for this genre and this culture.
Well, you know, like I said, you know, hip hop was at a really fragile time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember that they were very prominent. Radio DJs that were saying that hip hop was a fad and it was going to be over. And it's kind of like you're fighting for your legitimacy.
Yeah,
this is something
that
we do. This is something that we grew up doing, that someone is telling you when the start or end date is, who has absolutely nothing to do with the culture. So, you know, we were trying to, you know, protect what we had. So, you know, as ecstatic as we were that was the first year that the American Music Award and the Grammys were putting in a hip-hop category, it was kind of a slap in the face to realize that the Grammys weren't going to televise the hip-hop portion,
yeah.
and they were going to do it on an earlier telecast. And no disrespect to any other genre of music, but if you got 12 country and Western categories,
exactly.
you can slide one of them to the earlier right. categories to make way for hip-hop, especially at that point in time that hip-hop was probably the number four top-selling, you know, financially generated music mm-hmm. That they, you know, they didn't have enough respect for
yeah.
that they were going to air it earlier. And we said, if you don't televise it, we're not coming.
Dope. Yeah. And fast forward to today where hip hop is the number one genre. It's a $1 billion industry. So I would definitely say the stand that you guys took definitely worked in everyone's favor.
We sound crazy.
Here it is, a groove slightly transformed. Just a bit of a break from the norm. Just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has gotten to be a loop.
So we're coming into fall,
mm-hmm.
but when I got the word that I'd be talking to you and just the history that, the unprecedented history that you and Will Smith have made, I think about Summertime
mm-hmm.
And how that record, summer can't start until you hear that record, at least for me. Take me back to that moment where you all might have been in the studio or you all were conceiving the concept of this record. Like, what was it? Did it happen by just happenstance or was it an intentional effort to come up with that record? Just take me back to that moment.
Well, you almost have to credit that was the very first year that Will started the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Mm.
And he went to L.A. He went to L.A. probably in August.
Gotcha.
For people who don't know, it's summertime all year long in L.A.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, once we started getting to the spring, you know, on the East Coast, we have a different vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, once the spring comes, leaves start, you know, turning green, people start coming out. You know, it's a feeling and an emotion that the change of the season brings that he wasn't getting in Los Angeles. So he would pick up the phone and call me and just ask questions. Hey, have you seen such and such? Have you been to the plateau? Have you, you know, just the typical things that he was missing. And I think that is what more so inspired him, you know, to go down that path and write, because I think that was when we finally understood that there's a nuance to summertime that we have on the East Coast that some people on the West Coast don't have.
Wow. Wow, yeah, that record is definitely, I remember the video, just everything, like you wanted to go to the next family reunion after you saw that video. You brought up Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just another history-making moment, a series of moments on that show. Every Monday night, 8 o'clock, NBC, it was game time. Like, everybody rushed home. This was before social media, people, where you had the option to binge watch stuff. Like, no, we had to go home and catch the show every Monday. And it was a staple in our house, as was millions of other people around this country and the world. At what point, at playing jazz on that show, at what point in the series did you feel like, you know what, this is huge, this is something big? Did you notice it from the jump? Was it an ugly baby or was it a cute baby from the jump?
Man, like, I had zero desire to do that show.
Wow.
I was not trying to do that show. I was strictly music.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny because Will actually talks about it in his book that he really had to trick me to do the show. You know, when they asked me to do the show, I told them no. And he was just like, wait, Jeff said no? And I was just, nah, I'm cool. I'm all right. And he basically said, listen, you know, they want you to do 3 episodes. If you do one and you love it, you got 2 to look forward to. If you do one and you hate it, you only got 2 left to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And it was 6 years.
And the rest is history. I mean, you always look forward to the tossing of
But we didn't, you know, it was funny because I had zero desire to do television. I didn't know anything about television.
Wow.
I didn't realize that the people that know you from your music is one group of people.
Yeah.
80-year-old white grandmothers know you from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So that was a little bit different. I could walk through the mall, and if people who were into hip hop recognized you, that was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Walking through the mall after the TV show was very different.
Yeah, that was such a cultural moment, not just for us as people of color and black folks, but like, I remember going to school on Tuesday and we talking about Fresh Prince from the night before. And did y'all see the dad episode? And such an amazing moment. Still on the topic of Bel-Air, or Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, we're now glued to our televisions in another form. with Bel-Air, readaptation?
Reboot.
So I know season one was crazy. How involved are you with this new reboot? And is there anything you can tell us about season 2? Just from my personal
not,
say.
Well, not involved in the behind the scenes. I was one of the co-hosts of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a chance to see the episodes before everybody else did. I was really, really excited. I remember when I saw the pilot, I was so blown away of how the essence of Philly and the show was captured, you know. And you got to really give a lot of credit to Jordan, the director, because he really came to Philly and really dissected, you know, everything in that was authentic. There were people that I knew, there were streets that I knew, the way that they shot that, the dialogue, you know, it was so much that he put into, you know, making sure that the show was going to have a certain level of authenticity, especially it not necessarily being a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, he definitely nailed it. So I'm extremely excited, looking forward to this next season. I know they started filming.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting to find out whatever I can find out.
So you waiting just like the rest of us?
Yeah, I was the same way. Listen. I was sitting there waiting for them to send me the episodes so I could watch them.
Wait, so you get the episodes before, of course, you get to kind of check off.
Yeah, well, you know, they would send you the episodes, maybe two episodes before it would come out, so you could film the podcast that the episode comes out after, you know, they air it.
Gotcha. Another pivotal moment in your career that I personally, because I'm a R&B soul head to my core, you birthed A Touch of Jazz. And I mean, working with the likes of Jill Scott and Music Soul Child and The Roots and just so many, like what you guys did with that era, I mean, it's just unprecedented. And it really, we're still seeing the ramifications of that today. What was the transition from you being with DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, doing Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? What was that transition like coming from those moments in your career to actually birthing A Touch of Jazz, the label, the entity?
The funny thing, it really wasn't a transition. That was always there.
Yeah.
It just wasn't time to show people. You know, it was, you know, you got to keep in mind that in the 90s, people weren't really accepting you doing multiple things.
Yeah.
You know, the beginning of Will doing the TV show and being a recording artist was met with resistance in the beginning because people couldn't pretty much fathom you doing something other than what they knew you for, which is not the case today. Everybody has multiple jobs and multiple, you know, careers. Yeah. But, you know, back then it was a little bit rough. But, you know, I've always been music first. You know, not just the music that we made. You know, I grew up in Philadelphia, Gamblin' Huff, the Sound of Philly. Yeah. You know, so much of that is in my soul. But I knew people weren't going to necessarily be accepting of me, especially me, going down this path. Like, I really created A Touch of Jazz to hide behind it.
Mm.
You know, to you know, because it wasn't really, you know, accepting. You know, there's so many Easter eggs and that we've came up with fake names of records that were produced because I didn't want anybody to know it was me, you know, just to be accepted.
Wow. And you would think, I mean, you're DJ Jazzy Jeff.
Yeah, but you know, the first thing that people think of is DJ Jazzy Jeff is a hip hop DJ.
Yeah.
You don't think of me in any other genre of music, you know, besides that. And you had to kind of change that narrative. And, wow, you know, you had to sometimes sneak through the back door to change it.
Gotcha. Well, I want to touch on this subject. It's more of a sad subject. This week, because you're from Philly, we lost PNB Rock. He's also was a Philadelphian. Just kind of wanted to get your thoughts. Did you know PNB Rock? Were you able to meet him at any point? And just kind of wanted to get your thoughts. I know in my opinion, there's been a lot of deaths. We've been losing a lot of people, especially on the hip hop side. Just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on everything that's transpired this week.
The funny thing is I only met him through text. I used to throw a creative retreat at my house. And he texted me after the last one and was just like, hey, you know, introduced himself, which I already knew. And he was like, I'm from Philly. I would love to know how I could come to the next one. I kind of want to soak up the vibes. And I hit him back, was like, listen, you're on the list. I got you. You know, and that was it. You know, pretty much right after that, you know, the pandemic happened and everything shut down. So, but that was pretty much the only interaction that I had, you know. So it's definitely heartbreaking. Because, you know, in my era, we had Biggie and Tupac. And we still hold on to the Biggie and Tupac and how senseless that was. This is a whole different thing. This is a whole different thing that I'm trying to wrap my head around it. You know, it's a little bit different because I'm not necessarily in that age group, in that culture. But, you know, we are losing way too many, you know, to senseless violence, you know. And I don't know what you can really attribute it to. You know, times are different. Times are hard. You know, times were hard back when Biggie and Tupac. Yeah. You know, social media has a lot to play, you know, with it, that, you know, people, you know, showing too much. And there's some people that may not be happy with what you're showing, you know. Mm. And it's just, you know, it's a lot of different things to me that I think that you have to take in consideration. You know, two months ago, I was at that exact same Roscoe's with my family.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to think about that it's kind of like, wow, like this is a family restaurant that people go to, and this kind of, you know, thing happens, you know, and you don't want to put yourself in a position that you start sheltering yourself, but you always have to kind of keep your head on the swivel.
Yeah. I appreciate you for sharing that, and much respect and many prayers to his family.
Absolutely.
And my last question to you, what's next for DJ Jazzy Jeff? I know you're still out here on the turntables. You're still killing the game. What's next for you?
You know what's funny, and I don't like to say it, but the pandemic really helped me. You know, aside from being incredibly sick and blessed to be here.
So glad
The pandemic made me understand a few things. Mm-hmm. Once everyone was locked down, everybody's in the house, we started playing music online just to kind of help people get through the day. I think what I started to realize is grown folks don't really want to go to a club. We didn't know that. We didn't know that because we didn't really have an option.
Yeah.
But when I started streaming to grown folks, I started to realize that there are more people who don't want to go to a club than do go to a club. So we just continued streaming, and we stream, you know, we have Friday night house party streams that have over 100,000 people, you know, from around the globe. And I really enjoy, you know, I really enjoy bringing what I do and people like me to your living room.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've had guests, you know, from, you know, guys like Kid Capri that people haven't seen Kid Capri since they were at Howard's Homecoming in 1995.
Yeah.
You know, and now you can turn your TV on and he's in your living room, and you can invite your own friends over and fry your own chicken and sit and watch Kid Capri and not have to pay for parking.
Yeah, you all have definitely, you and a few others, definitely helped us get through, and I was able to kind of tune into some of the things that you've done over this whole craziness the last couple of years, and you all definitely helped us get through it. And so,
yeah, listen,
we appreciate
they helped
that,
us get through it too, because we needed to play that music.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate you, Mr. Jazz, and thank you for coming through and speaking with me today. Again, this is DJ Jazzy Jeff. Thank you for making. Where can we follow you on Instagram, Facebook,
all
that?
DJ Jazzy Jeff,
all that. Okay, so go follow him if you're not. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Congrats on everything. Man, such a legendary figure in so many of our lives. We've watched him on TV getting thrown out of that house on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. We've heard the music, and it was such an amazing honor to talk to DJ Jazzy Jeff. But it doesn't stop there. Next up is a man who I remember seeing on MTV back in the day when he was part of the legendary Beastie Boys. He's been considered the world's greatest DJ by USA Today and has also worked with Cypress Hill. Please check out my conversation with the legendary Mix Master Mike right here on We Sound Crazy. What's up, good people? It's Bacon for Making. I'm back, y'all, and I told y'all I'm on location here in Washington, D.C. at the RIAA offices. And we're just meeting the legends today, man. I mean, they're just coming in one by one. Right here with me, I have the legendary Mr. Mix Master Mike. How are you today, sir?
Doing awesome. Weather is beautiful.
Yeah, weather
in Washington.
Yeah, weather is great here. It's a lot better than where I'm coming from, Nashville, Tennessee. But yeah.
The weather in here is beautiful too.
Yeah, yeah.
A little cold, but it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we're here for the RIAA Honors, where we're celebrating hip hop, and we're coming up on 50 years next year. What comes to your mind when you think of just all of the transitions and everything that's happened with hip hop and now it being the number one genre and it being a $1 billion industry? What comes to your mind?
First thing that comes to my mind is my gratitude to Kool Herc. Mm. That's the first thing. Number one, numero uno. There, if there wasn't Kool Herc, there wouldn't be Mixmaster Mike. Wow. So kids, they need to know that, you know, mm-hmm. in order to know where you're from, yeah. you got to know where it began. And that's, Kool Herc.
As a young kid, and you watching people like Kool Herc and so many other pioneers of this culture, what was it that made you feel like, you know what, I can do that too? Like, what was the light bulb moment that you had? Do you remember the year? Do you remember the moment, the song, just what was it that made you feel like, you know what, I want to be a part of whatever that is?
Yeah, I mean, well, growing up from like the bottom, I mean, you try to figure a way out. Mm-hmm. When I heard like Rapper's Delight,
I said a hip hop, the hibbit of a hip hip hop, you don't stop, rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity bang bang, the boogie to the boogity beat.
That was probably the song that was like that kind of ignited my inspiration to get into the art or get into the study of hip hop, and so I was fortunate to be able to do that and apply my own style to the art. And what can I say? And that was in 83, 84.
Wow.
And I bought Rapper's Delight with all pennies.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a jar full of pennies and it was like 599 pennies. That's a true story.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how much I wanted that record.
Dedication, man.
You know what I'm saying?
Sounds like something I would have done in like the late 80s, early 90s with cassettes by the time those.
Oh, no. Cassettes are a whole nother thing now. So,
So you grew up in the Bay Area. How did the music from that area kind of help influence your music palette, I guess? What was it about growing up in that city that just kind of helped make you into the person that you are musically today?
Well, I grew up, before I was a DJ, I grew up with a clock radio mm-hmm. that had a cassette embedded on top. And I used to log on to these, I used to turn on the radio and listen to these hip hop stations. There was one called KPOO 89.5 mm-hmm. in San Francisco where they used to play all hip hop. And then I used to get tapes sent to me from my cousin from New York of the Magic, Mr. Magic show in Red Alert. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much like every Sunday religiously I would wait for these radio shows to come on. And that's where I was getting this lesson of hip hop, you know. And then I would record all of these these shows and I would hook up another clock radio to it. And then I would make my own versions of the show. Like all my favorite parts of the radio show, I would loop and loop and loop with the pause button. Mm-hmm. And I would make my own versions of what I thought that radio show should be like. So that's how my mind worked back in those days. I was 14 years old. So I was fully editing off two clock radios.
Typically, how long is a process like that where you're using the pause button to...
Long, because you got to rewind. Hit the record, pause, rewind, and then you got to, you know, keep doing that where it's like you're doing it in 8-bar loops of your favorite parts, all these breaks. And so it's just like, you know, and I wasn't drinking coffee back then. Yeah. Like I was a little kid. I was like, you know, usually, you know, in an editing station, you know, your caffeine, whatever, like your boost, whatever. But my excitement for the art was that strong, you know what I mean, to where I was like going to go the length to use that pause button and create my own compositions.
I'm so intrigued by this because I mean me recording from the radio and all that stuff back in the day, it's not as extensive as what you're describing, but how did you even have the forethought to even do that? I know in just kind of reading up on you, I know you said that you didn't have you couldn't afford a turntable, so you had to kind of resort to that. But like, how do you come to the thought of I'm gonna make these Pause mixtapes?
Well, I was just like, you know, I guess I was born an artist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Artist, composer.
Yeah.
I was at that age, I was like infatuated with art and looking at art, you know, Picasso's, Rembrandt's, like Van Gogh's at 14. Mm. You know what I mean? I would kind of study why people were intrigued by art. And so it's just like, I want to make art. I want to make sonic art. And that's what I always wanted to do, is make sonic art, something I could call my own.
Yeah. Do you still have some of those tapes?
I do, yeah. They're somewhere in the garage, in a hot garage somewhere, yeah. But yeah, I do. I have a wall of cassette tapes, like a wall of cassette tapes.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy.
Will we be able to hear some of that one day?
I don't know. I mean, if I have time to digitize all that stuff, it'd be awesome.
But, that'd be dope.
But there's some stuff like floating around the internet, like mixtapes and whatnot, but not the earlier stuff with the clock radio. I don't know where those went, but I mean, definitely probably a relic of hip hop.
Now, what are some of the music, like the album song / artists that kind of helped to build the foundation of what you eventually became?
Yeah, I was listening to a lot of, it's weird, it's funny, because I was listening to like Miles Davis, Autumn Leaves, and then I would listen to Led Zeppelin. You know, Zeppelin was like my favorite growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, it just grew to like, you know, Grandmaster Flash, Furious Five, Johns and Crew, all the electro stuff, and then all the hip hop stuff that followed that. You know what I mean? So it's just like I can't pinpoint one genre because I was listening to everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
Full ADHD mode. Like, I was listening to everything.
Yeah. I mean, for what you do, as the illustrious career that you've had, and you've worked with Cypress Hill and the Beastie Boys and just all of these great people, do you feel like that kind of helped set the tone? Just all of the music that you were listening to, the Miles Davises and all the...
Absolutely.
Do you feel like that helped set the tone for what
Absolutely.
You
did? Absolutely. I'm a music historian.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you could say, like, I'm a savant. Mm-hmm. I'm a musical savant. And, and I humbly say that, you know what I mean? It's like, this is what I was born to do. And it's like, there's constantly music playing in my head over mm-hmm. and over and over and over. Like, I'm always thinking about one-upping what I did yesterday.
So, speaking of the Beastie Boys, how did you, because you weren't with them from in the early days, you in, I think it was the 90s. So,
yeah.
How did you get to a point where I think I remember you saying you felt like you needed to be there? How did you get to that point? Like, what was it that made you say, you know what, I deserve to be up there with them?
Well, I mean, you know, my power of intention is really strong.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm the type to never take no for an answer. And I believe in what God has given me. And I believed that I was the missing element the whole time. But and it happened. I met Adam Yauch at a Rocksteady anniversary. Mm-hmm. After I had won the New Music Seminar, Battle for World Supremacy, I met Adam Yauch. And I mean, everyone was there. Like, it was, I remember like KRS-One, it was like Tribe, everyone was there. But then Adam was there, and Adam was the one I went to talk to. I could have talked to anybody, bust to anybody, but I went to Adam, and we hit it off. And he gave me his number and the whole thing. And then from there, I was sending him like DJ battle tapes of me winning the DMCs and all that. And then I would leave these crazy scratch messages on his answer machine. When he wasn't home, I'd be like, yo, Adam, check out this like reverse oyster scratch, or like check out this tweak scratch. And I would put the phone up against the speaker and I would do it. And then I left like three different messages, and that signal got through.
Wow.
I
mean, the art of manifestation.
Manifestation was real.
Crazy.
It was
crazy.
Real. Yeah. It was like, kind of for me, it's like an American dream, you know? It's an American dream. Like, they're like my all-time favorite group. So I was like grooming myself to be with them.
Wow.
Yeah.
We sound crazy.
So with the Beastie Boys, you became a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee in 2012. what was that initial feeling when you guys are accepting that honor? Like, how are you calling mama? Are you
honestly like excitement? But then, you know, my life is such a wormhole that you become numb to it, mm-hmm. and you just go with it. You just go with it, and then you look up and you go and you thank God. You know what I mean? That's what it is. Like, you put me in this position, and all these things happen after it. So it's just like, you know, of course, yeah, I call my mom.
Yeah.
And I remember my sister answering the phone when the Beastie Boys called the house, mm-hmm. and I was in the studio. My sister comes in, she's like, "Hey, Mike, the Beastie Boys are on the phone." And I'm like, "What?" And then that was the one moment, the wow. life changed there. And she gave me the phone, and it was Mike and Adam.
See, people, dreams do come true, man, for real.
Yeah, you just got to be very persistent in this business. You know, you got to believe. You got to have a lot of belief in yourself.
Crazy!
So you've been deemed the world's greatest DJ by USA Today.
Oh, my God.
And you became the first West Coast DJ to win the DMC World DJ Championships, and you won that 3 consecutive times.
Yeah, I won the New Music Seminar the first year as the West Coast first to win world title as a West Coast DJ, and then along with my crew, Rocksteady crew, me, Apollo, and Q, we won again the following year after that, and then me and DJ Qbert won the following year after that, and then the following year after that, they decided to retire us. So it was like,
let me ask you this, just to that point.
Yeah.
For someone that's out there, that's in the trenches, really mastering their craft of being a DJ and wanting to get to a point where they can get accolades such as that, what is your advice to those young men, those young women that are really wanting to get to your level?
Well, everybody is in, everyone's, I mean, artists today are like in demand of like the shortcut route.
Mm.
Right? Shortcut routes don't work.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go through, when I say like the trenches, like I went from the bottom all the way and just like, you know, I walked so far, you know, like the shoes, the soles were like, you know, developed all these holes, and I'm just like, yo, the soles were worn out. You know what I mean? I've done so much walking and studying, you know, mm-hmm. and studying the art. I mean, it's you just have to, you know, like I said, like Kool Herc, Grandmaster Flash, Grand Wizard Theodore. In order to know where you are today, you got to know where it came from. You know what I mean? A lot of these kids don't know, but it's not their fault. It's, you know, I guess it's bad parenting. You know what I mean? You got to show the youth. If I'm going to have kids, they're going to know about Zeppelin. They're going to know. They're going to know if they want. You know, if they're pursuing art, they need to know. You know what I mean? Because you know, you don't want your kids to get their card pulled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're an artist. You're a rapper. Okay. Who was that? Yeah. Who was who's the leader of Wu-Tang? Or you know what I mean? You got to know the culture. So that's what it is.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that because I remember as a kid my mom saying, you want to be in music, you need to know X, Y, and Z.
Absolutely.
We're going to play this.
Louis Armstrong, Hendrix, Thelonious Monk. Like, you got to know all these figures, mm-hmm. and they helped shape music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I want to add to that. You know what I mean? I you could say, like, I'm an offspring of those guys, Bonham and Miles. And I want to kind of, like, pave my own way. And use their philosophies, mm-hmm. into what I'm trying to develop, pretty much.
Yeah.
Crazy!
So you go from being a part of the Beastie Boys, working with them, and then you've worked with Cypress Hill as well, another legendary group. Like, I told you before we started, like, I grew up hearing your name and seeing you on MTV, like Kurt Loder saying Mix Master all the time, like on the back when there was MTV News. I don't know if that's still a thing now, but how did you get to a point where you were working with Cypress Hill as well?
Well, Cypress, Muggs and B-Real, like, are like my good friends.
Yeah.
Like, when I was with Beasties And I've always been good friends with those guys. So we just, you know, B-Real, like, offered the position. He was just like, you know, we want you to take us, do the same thing you did with the Beastie Boys with us. You know what I mean? As a you know, kind of like head coach of music or music director.
Yeah.
Wanted me to take that and run with it. So, but for me, I just wanted to tell you the truth. I just wanted to hang out with the guys. And I just wanted to see what it felt like to be on stage with them.
How did it feel?
You know what I mean? It felt great. Yeah. It was like hanging with my homies and just having a blast. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, as long as I had that non-smoking dressing room, which they gave to me. There was a Mixmaster mic non-smoking dressing room.
Got it.
On the Cypress tour. And they don't do that for anybody. So I felt, this is great.
Yeah, man.
But yeah, but it was total honor. I mean, come on. Like Cypress and from Cypress to Beasties to, you know. I have a huge crew. It's Cypress, Beasties. It's drum legend Steve Jordan. Mm. Steve Jordan now drums for the Rolling Stones, who is my partner as well. We have an album called Beat Odyssey 2020. And then Travis Barker is like my other partner. So I have a huge crew. I come in many forms. And then that's not adding to like my DJ crew,
you know,
the Invisible Scratch Pickles. So yeah. It's just this huge fleet. I'm part of a fleet.
Oh man, I mean, I'm sure your legendary status is rubbing off on the fleet is just as much as they're rubbing off on you, man.
I'm a shapeshifter.
So my last question to you is, like, you're still killing it.
I appreciate you, bro.
What's current? What's next? What's going on for Mixmaster Mike? 2022, 2023, like I said, we talked about earlier, we're coming up on 50 years of hip hop next year. Are you doing anything to celebrate that? What are we doing?
My life has been a celebration.
Yeah.
I celebrate every day. If you want to know more in detail, there's just so much going on with me. The eagle never lands. It never lands. I have a new album out called Ready Slayer One. Mm-hmm. You might want to pick that up or listen to that. Then doing shows with Travis, and then just a lot of stuff. Got a shoe coming out. I mean, just a lot of good stuff. And wouldn't be possible without my Lord and Savior. So I give him all the glory.
Man, what he said. Well, Mixmaster Mike, I appreciate you, sir.
Yes.
The legendary Mixmaster Mike. That's a wrap for We Sound Crazy with Mixmaster Mike. Thank you, sir.
My man, appreciate you.
Such an amazing conversation with Mixmaster Mike. It was so dope to just hear his heart for hip hop and to hear how he started out and how he became one of the world's greatest DJs. We're going to keep it right on rolling, y'all. This next young lady is literally one of my favorites in hip hop right now. Her albums, Layla's Wisdom and Eve, to me, are easily two of the most prolific hip hop albums of the last decade. And she brings a freshness to the genre that's so needed right now. We were able to talk about her love for hip-hop, her artistry, and some of her current projects. I'm talking about none other than the amazing Rhapsody right here on We Sound Crazy. Welcome back to We Sound Crazy. It's your boy Timon Bacon from Macon. Y'all, I'm still here on location here in D.C. And, I mean, they just... The hip-hop royalty and the amazing artists just keep coming through the door. I can't stop it. And I don't want to stop it. But this young lady sitting next to me is literally one of my favorites. She's such a breath of fresh air when it comes to hip hop, when it comes to music, period. Her wordplay is nuts.
Thank you.
And she's beautiful young lady that's championing hip hop in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. I'm talking about none other than the amazing Rhapsody. How are you?
I'm good. What an intro.
Wow.
Thank you. You gave me all those flowers.
You know, I'm
so honored.
You know, one thing about this podcast, shout out to Phil, Chuck, and Claude. We really try to make sure we give flowers where it's due. So
that's dope.
You deserve it. We're here in the RIAA offices. And
yes.
We're celebrating hip hop.
Yes.
As you landed here in D.C. and you knew you were coming to this mm-hmm. to celebrate so many pioneers of this culture, what's going through your head as
you're preparing for what we're about to see tonight?
If you want the raw, uncut, honest, I'm like, you're one of my biggest fears. You better not ever forget the lyrics to the legend's words when you honor them. So in my head, like I'm thinking about that music. But you know, especially for MC Light, there's no me without her, right? People say, you know, when did you know that you wanted to be a rapper? And I said, I was like 5 or 6 years old. And it was because I saw MC Light's Poor Georgia video. You know, just that story, the message behind it. Even at that age, I ain't know, but I knew. But she was the first female that I saw before I got to learn about Roxanne Shanté and Sha Rock. First female that I saw through television doing it. And she made me believe, like, oh, okay, women and girls have a place in this culture and in rap and in the industry. And it never left me, you know? So she was my light, literally.
Wow, yeah. She always think about when it comes to MC Light, I think the first time I saw her as a little kid, I'm 35. And so being super small and my aunt, she had it on the box from back in the day. You don't remember the box?
Well, I think the box was... I'm in North Carolina, so I don't know if we had the box, I've heard about the box.
So, like, the box back in the day played the self-destruction video, and I remember the hair and all that stuff, and then, of course, Roughneck and all that stuff. So, yeah, you definitely follow in that same lineage, and it's amazing to see. What would you say your favorite MC Light song and album is?
My favorite album is probably Light as a Rock.
Okay.
But my favorite song is Cold Rock the Party. When that video came on, them elevator doors open.
Yes.
Like, just, she looked so fly. She was bussing. It was fun. Missy's on it.
Yes.
Got the Puff Daddy remix. Like, you know, I was a kid. I wanted to dance.
Yes.
You know, that's my favorite song.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but 10% this, Roughneck, like, Poor Georgie, of course.
Yeah.
It's still one of my favorites.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Crazy.
So, with you being the amazing MC that you are, what would you say North Carolina did to kind of help build a foundation that brought you to who you are today, music-wise?
What I love about North Carolina is, musically, I feel like it's a melting pot, right? We're situated in the middle of the East Coast, so we're heavily influenced by the New York wave, but we also a car culture, and we're 6 hours from Atlanta, you know, so we like bass when we ride too, right? And I'm good friends with Terrace Martin, who's a jazz, legendary jazz artist. And one thing he made me realize is how much of an influence North Carolina had with musicians and the jazz movement, you know, especially in the Charlotte region. So I'm even learning more about our history. But I just think that sound-wise shaped me, right? I love music that has soul in it. It gotta touch me. You know, whether we partying or you talking about love, it has gotta cut through my body, right? And I think that's the jazz and soul and blues element, you know, and part of the history of North Carolina. But even like that raw New York, we got so many HBCUs, so you know, they would bring the music there. And I remember just hanging with my cousins. And, you know, one of them so influenced by Nas. His nickname was Nas, right? And you know, and just what that was. So that's what I just loved about North Carolina. People say, like, we don't, when it comes to hip-hop, we don't necessarily have a true identity. And I could say, because we listen to everything, and we poured everything, and we're influenced by everything. So, you know, that's what I love about North Carolina.
I do feel like North Carolina is kind of like a... I went to school in Columbia, South Carolina, so...
That's a different world.
Very different world. Very different world. But I know a lot of people that come from North Carolina, and they tend to have an ear for music from up top, music from the South. And so
West Coast, too.
So I'm interested in knowing, what is your first music memory? Like, the first time you remember, like... It was a cassette you bought back in the day. just what is it that you remember that the light bulb went off and said, oh, God, what is this?
Oh, I have so many of those, like, moments.
Yeah.
Some are funny. But I probably had to take it all the way back to just, like a lot of us, falling in love with Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a kid, I was like, every kid wanted to be Michael Jackson. Couldn't moonwalk, couldn't sing. but it was mostly like me and my dad would get up on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. That's outside of basketball, one thing we connected on. We would watch Video Soul together, and he would put a VHS in the, and record all the Video Soul's countdowns, and we watch go back and watch them back on other days. So, you know, Donnie Simpson, and, you know, it was things like that. You know, it wasn't one particular artist, but those just moments of seeing how much music played a part in my life, my parents' life, how much they influenced me. You know, in our household, like a lot of Black households, we had to get up on Saturday morning and clean up.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had a speaker, a hammer to a tree outside. You know, he would go outside and cut grass, but he played Luther, his favorite artist. My mom loved Tina Turner. So while, you know, we cleaning the bathroom, kitchen, on our knees, cleaning the floor, she playing Tina Turner and Patti LaBelle. And that's where I get my heavy soul influence. So those are, like, my favorite memories. Like, you know, just having those moments with music and creating memories with your family.
Wow. You said Video Soul. That really makes me smile ear to ear because I remember every Friday waiting on those countdowns, every night having to go to bed at 9 o'clock. But, you know, wanted to watch Video Soul that those 2 hours every night. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I definitely feel you when you talk about Donnie Simpson and Video Soul. It's one of the reasons why I love music the way that I do today.
Mm-hmm. Crazy!
I've heard you in other interviews talk about how you don't want to be boxed in as a female rapper.
Mm-hmm. No labels.
You just, you're straight up in MC, and you've proven that time and time again. Why is it important to not have, for you, why is it important to not have those labels?
Yeah. I'm going to be real. Like, I sit on the fence, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I came in and female rapper to me just meant something. Mm-hmm. You know, it just represented women, you know, who weren't showcased as highly as men and just gave us a name. And it was something to be proud of, right? But when I got in it, you know, I felt like it held us back, right? Mm-hmm. Because it separated us. Where it's like, you know, women go over here and play, it's the man sport, but y'all cute over there, like have fun, oh, that's dope, but it's a man sport, and it's really not, you know? And so that's what it was. You know, you'd see, these are the best hip-hop artists, and these are the top 10 female. And like, why are we not included in the best overall? Like, I don't understand that. It's not like basketball where we physically different, and even that is being erased, mm-hmm. like, I just saw a woman dunk with two hands. Like, oh, I never seen it like she did it. But, you know, it's all creativity and in the mental. And I know a lot of women that could out-rap men, but, you know, they don't get that same respect and notoriety. So, you know, it was my thing. Like, yo, don't label me as a female rapper like we other. We just artists at the end of the day. Yeah. We all MCs. I just happen to be a woman, you know? So that's what it is. But I'm proud to be a woman and just doing it, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you are doing it and doing it.
Crazy!
Emit light rap or emit teal. I drew a line without showing my body, that's a skill. Bad to the bone and the grill. You be dead wrong if looks kill. I'm
still on your my last album, Eve.
Yeah.
Nuts.
thank you.
You were intentional about just uplifting influential Black women and kind of naming the songs after different women that have graced our culture. How did you come to even think you were gonna do that? Like,
I've been doing it like bits and pieces my whole career, mixtapes and things. But I was doing an interview with a guy by the name of Lamar Wilson, and his interview was connecting the lineage of Nina Simone and Roberta Flack to me. He was doing like a musical genealogy of North Carolina music, and he was like, "Yo, you're a direct descendant of Roberta Flack and Nina Simone." It never hit me like that, and I sat with that all day. And when I went home that night, I did this song that I had been wanting to do for a long time about just being a tomboy, mm-hmm. and you know how flat it is, especially in a business that really promotes hypersexuality mm-hmm. and doesn't really have balance. But it was just like, yo, I'm just comfortable being a tomboy, and I was inspired by Aaliyah. You know, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna call it Aaliyah.
Are you that somebody that's gonna keep it real with yourself?
When I did that, I was like, you know, when I think about me and who inspires me, you know, a lot of women are part of my story, whether it's Aaliyah, Lauryn Hill, outside of, you know, my village of aunts and my mom. But, you know, Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou, Felicia Rashad, Cicely Tyson, like, I looked up to them and I'm super inspired by them. And it's just like, I'm bits and pieces of all of those. And it just shows the importance of representation, right? So it was a way for me to, like, give parts of me. And, you know, because even people box me in not only as a female rapper, but because of the music I make. Oh, you conscious. You probably don't like to go party like we like to party. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And it was like, nah, like I'm the home girl. Like, yeah. I'm super well-rounded. Like, you know, I grew up doing this and I like this person, you know? So it was a creative way for me to show love and respect and educate through music with these women's names, but also give pieces of me. And I felt like all Black women could relate because we all pieces of each other at the end of the day. So, yeah, I did Cleo, like, yo, I get mad sometimes too, yeah. Right? You know, you do other songs like Iman, you know, be like, I love myself. I love being Black. So, you know, that's what it was about.
It's a great record.
Thank you.
Crazy! I do have a question because you are a part of, I've been seeing you talk a lot about On the Come Up.
On
your IG and your
so
Twitter.
So excited about it.
And that by the time people see this, it will already be out.
Nice.
How did you become, how were you tapped to be a part of this project? How is it working with Sanaa Lathan and Method Man?
That was amazing. Sanaa Lathan, she reached out. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, we connected on Zoom and she told me, you know, it was her first chance of sitting in the chair being a director, and she was doing this movie On the Come Up, and she wanted to be authentic about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and she wanted somebody that spoke to the character. You know, and we talked a little bit. She gave me an assignment. She's like, you know, go, I'm gonna send you the script, read the script, you know, tell me how you feel about it. There's some battles in there. Can you write like one battle? And I went and wrote 5 or 6, and she was like, all right, it's you, right? And, you know, I just saw myself in Bree. If you haven't read the book, On the Come Up, it's about a 16-year-old girl named Bree who grows up in Garden Heights. And the book is written by Angie Thomas, who also wrote The Hate U Give. And it just talks about her come-up story of, you know, being a young girl, wanting to come up in a battle rap scene, you know, and just the things that she has to think about. You know, a lot of us come in this, we want to be pure artists with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's about, you know, finding your authenticity, being true to yourself. But, you know, as artists, we go through it like, yo, that's hot. Or I'm going through a situation. I need money fast. And just, you know, it talks about how she faced that and overcame it to really just walk in her light. And it was an amazing experience. I love Sanaa. She's a great leader, director, super humble. She cares about the culture. That was one thing. She was like, when you write these raps, don't dumb it down. I don't care if they got to watch the movie 4 or 5 times, which we want them to do. But, you know, I want them to really understand the genius of what hip hop is, and especially what we're focusing on is battle rap here. You know, and I appreciated that, you know, and she, you know, very inclusive, you know, and she has vision and she knows what she wants. Like, we were doing music for it. And she might not have the lingo, but she would be like, yo, I want this to feel like an anthem. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it should be a chant here. Right. And, you know, that was really dope that she had a vision and, you know, that we could work together to make something that I think is going to be a classic film.
I can't wait to see it. Paramount Plus, right?
Paramount Plus. But we also just got a theatrical release. So it's in 600 theaters across the United States.
Nice. Yeah. Well, y'all make sure y'all check that out. And final question. After On the Come Up, you know, the amazing album from a couple years back, will we get new music from you soon?
Oh, yeah. I've been working on music since the pandemic started. Nice. And I did Eve. I went on 2 tours. And as soon as we had to sit down, I started recording. So I got a lot of music. That's probably what's taking too long. I got too much music. But yeah, I have a new album out next year, 2023.
Mm. Yes, yes. Well, I appreciate you.
Thank you so much
for sitting down and talking with me. We sound crazy here at the RIAA Honors with the amazing Rhapsody. And that's a wrap.
Such a dope experience to talk to one of the dopest MCs in hip hop right now. Rhapsody, thank you so much. And y'all, please go support On the Come Up. That's starring Sanaa Lathan, streaming on Paramount Plus right now. And I cannot wait to hear her new project that's set to drop next year. We're going to keep it rolling, y'all. So this next young man has been a fixture in many of our lives for years now. He's currently the host of his own morning show on V103 in Atlanta, Georgia, but we've seen him on BET for years as host of Rhapsody, The Basement, and at one point, host of 106 in Park. I'm talking about none other than the legendary Big Tigger. Check it out. I am here with yet another legend, man. It just keeps on going, y'all. Mr. Big Tigger.
Wait, I got lumped into the legends?
Yes,
nice.
You legend. You legend, man. Like, I mean,
I'll take it.
As a kid, I mean, just watching you every day and now hearing you, because you're in my old stomping grounds, Atlanta. I mean, it's just it's just amazing. It's such an honor to meet you, sir.
Thank you.
We're here at the RIAA offices, celebrating hip hop. You are an integral part of hip hop and what we've seen as kids growing up via BET and just from all of your work in media. I've been asking everybody today, just what is your mind frame right now thinking about just what we started with hip hop and how it's grown into this huge billion-dollar industry today?
The interesting thing, and this is going to date me for real. Okay, so I'm going to own this for the first time ever. Hip hop was born the same year I was born, 1972.
Okay.
I think that is not by mistake. Mm-hmm. My maturation, its maturation has gone hand in hand. I am on my tombstone to the end of my days, excited and proud of the fact, that the show that I was on was part of the fabric of hip hop.
Yeah.
That helped introduce people, that helped educate people, that helped spread the gospel of hip hop, if you will. Mm-hmm. And where we are now, the fact that there's even a celebration of hip hop by the RIAA is kind of a thing. You know, when they wrote it off so early, we didn't get the awards, the accolades, the money. And now it is the dominant genre of music worldwide. I'm immensely proud and what hip hop has done, not only for me, but for the world.
Crazy. What is your first memory of hip hop? Like, what was that moment where the light bulb just went off for you?
I was in the Bronx. I was a little kid from the Bronx. Okay. And, you know, the birthplace of hip hop, so to speak, and being outside, you know, watching them plug it up to the light, you know, like watching them do stuff and, you know, break dancing and b-boying and all of it. Like, I grew up in the midst of that. I learned how to DJ when I was 13, 14. I've been beatboxing since I was 11. Like, I started rhyming at, like, the same time I started DJing. I used to break dance. I did a little graffiti.
Wow.
I mean, like, so for me, hip-hop has been a part of my life since I can remember. Mm-hmm. I think the first record I bought was Rapper's Delight.
Yeah.
I think I was five. Like, yeah. But I remember it. For hip hop to have been provided me and so many with so much is the ultimate amazing feeling about it all. So, I mean, I just, the light bulb kind of went off for me at like age 13, 14. And my father used to say, "You ain't got nothing with this hibbity bibbity, this hibbity bibbity bebop, whatever. You can't make no living with the hibbity bibbity bebop."
Yeah.
And one of my finest and proudest moments was me being able to do something really dope for my father and my stepmom, mm-hmm. because of the hibbity bibbity bibbity.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Hip hop has given me everything that I am, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Wow.
my generation, I'm 35. Mm-hmm. My generation, we remember coming home from school.
4 o'clock?
4 o'clock every day, BET Rap City basement.
Right.
And you were a mainstay with us every day. And then, of course, you transitioned over to 106 in Park. Mm. Talk a little bit about just the journey you've walked with the iconic BET and just how you've been able to, you know, you stayed in the hearts of all of us since then, even though, you know.
It's been 16 years since I left that iconic program. Not a day has gone by where somebody has said, bring back Rap City.
Yes.
For me, that is probably one of the most gratifying parts of it, that something was so impactful, mm-hmm. something that people revered and wanted to see and enjoyed so immensely that I was a part of, is my legacy, and I'm very proud of that. The transition from, at one point in my maturation, I said, I don't want to just be the hip-hop guy.
Okay.
I think I have more to bring to the table. I want to spread out. And then the ultimate, and I'm going to blame Ludacris. Ludacris was kind of the pivotal moment when the basement started to come to an end. It was his third time coming. Maybe it was his fourth. It was his fourth time coming in like 7 years. He just kept dropping albums. And he didn't want to go in the booth. And he's like, there's nothing me and him can do in that room that's going to be better than the first three times. And I think that was the moment when everybody was like, oh, wow. Like, maybe there needs to be a switch up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rap City, the basement, Big Tick, Ludacris, JC, DTP, talk.
Ludacris, third album, still whooping they ass. Still travel overseas with over 10,000 cash. Enough money in the chain to keep a country fed. People ask why the skull is because I like getting. And they wonder if I'm good. Hell yeah, it's a great feeling. I got bongs tall as the Empire State Building. What more could I want? I get it and waste it. Only thing left to take is Rap City in the basement. Snatch the furniture, or here's the plan. Kidnap Big Tigger and hold him for 10 grand. Tell BET if they want to see him again. Bring Freeze, Annihilathan, and a bottle of gin.
It just so happened that Free and AJ decided to move on at the time. They decided to move on, and BET wasn't really yet moved. They hadn't really decided what they were going to do with 106 in Park, and me being the senior talent on staff at the time, they was like, Tig, you got it. And I was like, all right, I got it. And for me, it was still music. It was still the live part of it, which Rap City was not. The live part of it was even more fun for me, interacting with the kids on the show and just acting up and acting a fool. And again, just being in people's homes every day for 2 hours, delivering what the culture was gratifying. So, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed Rap City. I enjoyed 106 in Park. And I enjoy everything that I've been doing ever since.
There's just nothing like the energy that you bring, man.
Thank you.
It's contagious.
Crazy.
My last question to you before we wrap up. Mm-hmm. What are you've been in this for so long. You've seen so many different transitions and phases of this thing we call hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on just where we are now and where we started and where we've come to today?
I have moments where I sound like my dad.
Okay.
Y'all music is as good as our music.
Yeah.
And then I have moments where I absolutely appreciate some of the newer artists, some of their music, some of their artistry. Hip hop has never been as big. I mean, you could argue the 90s when it really like kaboom.
Yeah.
The 90s and the 2000s when it took off. But I mean, what it is as an industry for its impact. I mean, when I was growing up, there wasn't no hip-hop commercials.
I mean, wow.
Yeah. Think about every commercial now has, you know what I'm saying?
A hip-hop undertone to it. Yeah.
So the way that it's become not mainstream, but it is the stream.
It is.
Hip-hop is the stream. It's refreshing to see. As a lyricist, as an artist, I wish that more of the younger artists would take more... a lot more. The popular artists would take more interest in their lyrical content. I think we can do better on that front, but that doesn't mean that they don't make good music. Mm-hmm. It'll never be our music, because that was our music. We grew up, we lived it, we breathed it. But I am extremely happy with where hip hop is, and happy to have been a small influence in helping to get there.
Wow. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just glad that you're still here to tell the story.
How about that?
And you mm-hmm. are a legendary.
Thank you.
Legendary figure, and like I said before, you're still in the hearts of all of us that grew up watching those shows as kids. So thank you for your contribution. Big Tigga, Bacon for Making, We Sound Crazy, and we're out.
Amen.
Listen, y'all, it's not every day that you get to speak with someone who is responsible for bringing the culture right to you in your living rooms every day. And that's who Big Tigger is. He's still doing his thing in the media world, and we're so thankful for his legacy. But we're not stopping there. Stay tuned for part two with DC legend DJ Kool, veteran industry exec Jeff Halston, the iconic MC Light, and one of the originators of hip-hop, Grandmaster Flash. I'm Bacon for Making, and that's a wrap.
Just waking up in the morning, gotta thank God. I don't know, but today seems kinda odd. No barking from the dog, no smoke.